This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
I'm Rosie. I'm going to be chairing this session. And this is Cy Engler, who has written this book, which is available if you guys don't know about the book room, which is to the right of the registration table. Please go and check it out. It's a pop-up bookstore that exists only at this conference during this weekend. And there are a lot of great books in there, including this one. So Cy is a lecturer at Leiden University in the Netherlands. He works on settler colonialism, Zionism, labor movements, and anti-Semitism. He's a member of the editorial boards of Notes from Below and Historical Materialism, and he's going to talk about this book today and settler colonialism in general. Take it away.
Okay, I'll stand. I'm going to take my mask off. And I'm going to put my timer on in a desperate attempt to discipline myself to stick to time. So thanks so much, Rosie, for the introduction and for agreeing to chair. I'd like to thank the organizers, Haymarket, particularly Charlotte and Oscar, who made me coming over possible, and thank all of you for choosing to come to this session and making this discussion possible. The book is an introduction, as the title extremely unoriginally suggests, and I'm going to try today to tease out some of the things that I think are the most important to have that discussion. Because it's an introduction, it's not necessarily an original piece of work. I try also to make a lot of the what I think is some of the most important literature and debates available for people in the book. I'm not going to spend my time today referencing and citing who I'm talking about, but if you're interested, it's in the book, so you know you can get it. And I should say that there's a couple of arguments that have sort of emerged around the book, particularly on the question of settler labor. And I haven't actually planned to talk about it in my introduction, but if people, and I recognize some people who've engaged in a discussion with me, want to bring it up in a discussion, I think that'd be really interesting, and particularly, I think, in terms of thinking about the situation in Palestine today, I think it'd be useful, so it's a prompt for those people to help me out, something I'm going to leave out, but that you can bring in. Some of the people laughing are the people I'm talking about. So I'll move on swiftly. So I think to talk about settler colonialism today is important for a whole number of reasons, and one of them, of course, is I think it's really become, or increasingly becoming, an area of political argument, confrontation, particularly in the context of the genocide in Palestine. And so the idea of settler colonialism has moved quite quickly from debates, I think, largely in academia or on the left, and obviously in indigenous movements for national liberation, into the mainstream. And so for those of you who have the bad luck of looking at the Atlantic at times, you'll have noticed that they've started running a number of pieces that have sort of identified settler colonialism as the latest fad in the kind of dangerous woke ideas that will tear down Western civilization from within. Which, you know, yeah, from their mouths to God's ears, as they say. But I do actually think that points to a number of reasons why I think it's important to make sense of settler colonialism and to think through it. I think to identify the nature of a problem, an issue, is also to start laying the groundwork for thinking about how to resolve it. It's no surprise that this is coming to the fore in the context of a growing movement of solidarity with the Palestinian people in the middle of what is now, is it 11-month long a genocide? Because, of course, to understand the Israeli state as a settler colonial state points to extremely different ways to think about liberation than the way it tends to be framed in liberal discourse. I would say two brief things on that. One is that I think it's important, and that's what I'm going to try to do today, to think of settler colonialism not as a theory or an idea, but as a particular colonial process, a particular form of accumulation on a world scale, use the formulation by Samir Amin, and a particular way in which domination, dispossession, and accumulation has been or was made possible historically and continues to be made possible today. And so it's a material reality that I'm interested to make sense of, one that is centrally imbricated both in the birth and the reproduction of capitalism, and I think therefore also in its destruction. Making sense of it as an extremely long history, one that certainly goes back as far as the emergence of settler colonialism 500 years ago, give or take, and one unlike the idea, there's a book that unfortunately Rosie tells me is going to do extremely well, that's coming out sort of denouncing the idea of settler colonialism, and that starts, I have the unfortunate luck of having read some of it already, by saying it's an idea that emerges 20 years ago in an Anglo-Saxon context. There's, of course, an extremely long literature. My book tries to point to some of it that deals with it, lots of different moments to think about. For example, in the 60s and 70s, both in North America and the emergence of the kind of the Red Power movement, or in the Middle East, in the publications of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the idea of settler colonialism, the idea that indigenous movements faced a particular form of colonialism that they called settler colonialism, was central to their theorizations and to the development of their movements. Where a conference called Socialism, Marx debated with a number of other political economists of his time, people like E.G. Wakefield, about what he called at the time classic colonialism. And I think it also tells us something that by the mid-19th century, that was still what classic colonialism was. The overwhelming form of colonialism was settler colonialism. And all of these things, I think, point to the kind of ludicrous idea that settler colonialism is a sort of a new fad rather than both a long historical reality and one that a whole number of people have tried to understand in order to think through how to get out of it and linked it to the history of capitalism. So I'll try to do three things. One is to say what it is, two, how I think it played a central role in developing some of the forms of control and oppression that remains with us today, and three, to think about how it connects to, as I've already pointed out, the emergence and the reproduction of capitalism. So the first thing to say briefly, I think, is what is it? Settler colonialism is counterposed to franchise colonialism. So if you think about the British in India or the Dutch in Indonesia, that established colonial power, largely externally, which is to say, of course, through military invasion and military power, and through the presence of colonial administrators, but who would come and go from the colonial dominion. Settler colonies, on the other hand, are organized by the permanent displacement of populations, metropolitan populations, into the territory in order to control it. And as an aside, something to, you know, maybe do further kind of thinking about in the future or in our discussion, I also think it's not for nothing that as late as the mid-19th century, political theorists would talk about it as the classic form of colonialism. I think it says something that until very late, until really the kind of the pinnacle of the Industrial Revolution, the only way in which European states were able to maintain their power across an empire on a global scale was by moving populations that were able to establish their presence on territories that made land, resources, and labor available for exploitation, dispossession, and circulation on a world scale. And I'll say more about that in a moment. But because, and so settler colonies, we are in one. The Israeli colonization of Palestine would be another example. Australia, New Zealand, much of Latin America, et cetera, would be South Africa, Algeria, until the 1960s, et cetera, would be other examples. Because settler colonialism established its ability to accumulate through the movement of a metropolitan population that establishes itself on the land and tries to reproduce the metropolitan society in the colony, it leads to a continuous conflict between that population that is there continuously, reproduces itself, and expands its control over land, people, and resources with the populations, the indigenous populations that are already present in the land. And so the idea of a continuous conflict that is primarily organized around the question of land lies at the center of how people have understood settler colonialism at different moments in history. And we can talk about that in the discussion. I'm not going to go into it so much now, but contemporary theorists of settler colonialism have, for that reason, really emphasized the question of elimination, to say that central to that process is the need for the population that is establishing its control over the land to do away with the existing societies. And of course, that's absolutely true in lots of different places, the United States certainly not being an exception to the rule, and what we're seeing in Palestine for the moment being a further kind of idea that the process of elimination, of extermination, of genocide remains an absolutely central part of settler colonialism. At the same time, I want to raise or call to us to kind of think about the fact that there's a danger, I think, in overly emphasizing the idea that that's the automatic outcome, and that actually in the history of settler colonialism, and what I try to do in the book, is to show that because that process is a struggle, because it's a continuous conflict between settler populations and the indigenous populations that they encounter, it leads to a whole number of different outcomes in different historical situations, depending on the balance of forces between settler and indigenous populations. Largely, settler colonialism in the African continent, for example, established itself primarily on exploiting a majority indigenous population rather than trying to eliminate it. If you look at the long history of Palestine, or of the colonization of Palestine over the last 100 or so years, you can see a continuous pendulum in Israeli strategies between trying to exploit Palestinians and integrate them into the economy and trying to get rid of them. And that's important, I think, both to avoid overly theological kind of ideas of confusing the desires of colonial processes and what they're actually able to achieve. It might be that settlers want to do away with indigenous populations. If you read the text of settler movements in North Africa, French settler movements in North Africa throughout the 19th century, they keep talking about their desire to do away with the populations they encounter. But wanting that is not the same as being able to do it. And so what it also does, I think, is to bring back the possibility of agency, of resistance, and of failure of settler colonial projects, and the kind of the obvious way in which that gets talked about, not just by myself, is that in places where settler colonies were dependent on the exploitation of indigenous populations, overall, it led to extremely different societies and also to very different outcomes. Across the African continent, settler colonies were defeated, largely because of the ability of indigenous liberation movements to shut down settler economies. I think if you look at Latin America, you get extremely different sets of politics that emerge out of the mobilization of indigenous liberation movements that are located also in labor movements and play kind of central roles in a whole number of different historical events that I don't have the time to talk about. We can talk about it more, but the important thing, I think, is to say that what I think is important is that the central logic is one of conflict, one of conflict that generates particular social relations that are different in different historical, geographic, and political situations, and that what an analysis of particular settler colonial power needs is to do both, is to make sense of the fact that there is a central logic of conflict that is absolutely based on the irreconcilable desire of a settler population to establish its control over a territory and the fact that it encounters existing populations in the process that oppose that political project, but the fact that those struggles, those tensions, those conflicts can lead to very different outcomes and political realities, and I think happily so, in the sense that it means that that failure is also possible in the process. So what do we mean by indigenous and settler? I think on the surface, that can seem pretty uncomplicated. I've just described that it's a colonial project that displaces a metropolitan population and establishes it in a territory that it attempts to control. And so that the settlers are the populations that are being moved and the indigenous populations are the populations that are there already. Sure. I think that's a limited way to try to think through what happens, largely because I think those processes, again, aren't so seamless. Is that throughout the kind of history of settler colonialism, and I'll give some examples, you get examples of populations that are moved to be colonizers who decide that actually, and that happens a lot in the early process of British colonization in North America, that life in the exploitative industries of the colonies isn't really what they signed up for, and that the liberty that they find in some, not all, indigenous societies not structured by capitalist social relations is much more interesting, and that they flee, for example. And so the book Many-Headed Hydra, thank you so much, The Many-Headed Hydra, deals with lots of those kind of historic experiments and the way in which these identities are able to move. Similarly, for what we might think of indigenous, it seems to us at the end of 500 years of a process of colonization that that identity is uncomplicated. But of course, it needed to be imposed by colonial powers that did away with a whole number of local political, national, social differences to create a new identity, which was an identity that they understood as inferior to themselves. And so that I think it's useful to think about how those identities are constructed and imposed, as well as how they then become mobilized by the people on which they are imposed in the process of struggle and of liberation. There's a quote by Kevin Brunel, who talks about this process in North America, and he says, only after centuries of European-based conquest, colonization, and settlement in North America did terms like Indian or indigenous gain any meaning at all. By setting the collective identity of people such as the Cherokee, the Pequot, the Mohawk, the Chippewa, and hundreds of other tribes and nations into contrast with the emerging Eurocentric settler society. It was not until the 1700s that tribal groups in the East, and he quotes a colonial officer in this process, tribal groups in the East were beginning to see themselves as having something in common together as opposed to the Europeans. The words Indian or American Indian or Native American, Aboriginal, Indigenous emerged as a product of a co-constitutive relationship with terms such as colonizer, settler, and American. And what a whole number of authors have talked to is that really the identity of the settler and the indigenous is to be understood in the process of accumulation. What kind of accumulation is taking place? A form of accumulation which is based primarily on dispossession, on theft, on displacement, on expulsion. The idea that land, resources, etc., are to be captured, are to be separated from the populations that live on them, enjoy them, use them before. And so really that the idea of who is indigenous or settler is who is being ascribed by the colonial power the right to dispossess and the right, so-called, to be dispossessed, the right to control and the right to be controlled, the right to expel and the right to be expelled, etc. These are identities that are constructed, that are imposed, And importantly, again, that move through history at different times and in different places. There's a number of kind of different examples, but I think one of the things that's useful as a way to think about what I mean is also the fact that some of the populations that are sort of previously present are at times mobilized by colonial projects and incorporated into the settler population. And that's often done in situations of a numerical or political weakness where the settler population is not able to overwhelm indigenous populations and therefore tries to, and so again, it's about the idea that identities move and change over time. An important example, I think, is that of Jewish populations in North Africa. The French are, for a whole number of reasons, that again, there's people in the room that have a lot to say about that. The French economy is unable to kind of crush the peasantry in the same way that the British are. They have much less populations that are freely able to move around and therefore to send to the colonies. And at no point are they really able to fundamentally overwhelm the North African populations. What they do is that at the very time where they start to codify what it means to be indigenous, and there's literally a code of indigeneity in the French colonies in North Africa, so the idea of what the indigenous is and what the lack of rights that those populations have are, at the same time, the French are going to announce that every single Jewish person that lives, so North African Jews, that lives under the French control is to be made French. So it's to be integrated into the settler population. And you see that kind of logic. And so that, for example, I think is a useful way to say that just the kind of historicity, the history of the who was where when is kind of insufficient to make sense of this relationship of indigenous and settler. Dutch settler colonies had much the same problem, and so really encouraged miscegenation in the different places where they found themselves, so encouraged the settlers they did have to marry the men, to marry with indigenous women in order to create more settlers, as it were. If you read British colonial officers who arrive in South Africa in the 19th century, they're sort of horrified by what they consider to be absolutely inappropriate racial relations in South Africa, because the Dutch are encouraging these processes of miscegenation in order to try to create a settler population that they are unable to simply export from the Netherlands. There's many other examples that I could talk about. Of course, something being imposed doesn't mean that it's not something that also can be mobilized in resistance. And so if you go back to the quote I read before, the fact that it takes 200 years for British settlers, for example, in the Americas to impose sort of a collective identity on a whole host of nations that it encounters in the process of colonization, doesn't also mean that those identities can't become vectors of resistance. And of course they do. In the process of collectivizing these disparate identities under the banner of those who can be dispossessed, murdered, expelled, exploited, etc., the colonizers also generate new identities that are important vectors of resistance. And here, I'll briefly use a quote from Tayake Alfred and Jeff Korntassel, who write, "Indigenous is an identity constructed, shaped, and lived in the politicized context of contemporary colonialism. There are, of course, vast differences amongst the world indigenous peoples in their cultures, political, economic situations, and in their relationships with colonizing settler societies. But the struggle to survive as distinct peoples on foundations constituted in their unique heritages, attachments to their homelands, and natural ways of life is what is shared by all indigenous peoples, as was the fact that their existence is in large part lived as determined acts of survival against colonizing states' efforts to eradicate them culturally, politically, and physically." And so here again, the idea that an imposed identity, an imposed logic of collectivization also leads to collective forms of resistance inside of particular settler colonies, but also on a global stage. And so we see the kind of the particular relations that emerge, for example, in the context of the current genocide in Gaza, and how indigenous populations around the world recognize what Israel is doing to the Palestinians today as processes that they are intimately familiar with. At the hands of their own colonial states. I'm obviously doing very badly for time already. I'll very briefly say something about the fact that that process is, of course, intimately linked to the process of racialization and to the process of imposing the idea that that difference, the difference between who can be dispossessed and who can do the dispossessing leads to new ideas on a global scale that attempt to present that not as the outcome simply of power and conquest, but as biological, cultural, internal realities that are naturally true rather than the outcome of an imposition. And I don't have the time to really do it justice, so you'll have to look at the book. But I promise you I'll send you a PDF if you want to. I don't know if I can say that publicly, but whatever. No, read the book. That the creation of these differences can really be traced through from conquest to the deepening and institutionalization of settler power on a global terrain. And so that you see very different forms of racialization emerging in different colonial contexts in an attempt to institutionalize and reproduce the particular forms of domination that I've talked about. So I've already given the example of the difference between British and Dutch colonialism, for example, but also about how different populations are racialized. So an example that is often used in the literature is the way how in the United States, but not only, populations that are racialized as black and populations that are racialized as indigenous are racialized in extremely different ways. And so the idea of the nature of blood becomes central to that idea. So the idea is that indigenous blood is weak and can be disappeared through miscegenation, and so that there is an attempt at encouraging the integration of indigenous populations into white society through intermarriage. And so you have very complicated calculations that different settler societies develop at what point exactly an individual stops being indigenous based on the amount of white blood that has sort of overwhelmed the indigenous blood. I assume it's not necessary to say that there is no such thing, that it's insane and that it's not a biological reality, but what it represents is a particular form of control, which is of course linked to the attempt at disappearing indigenous populations in order to be able to conquer their land. If people disappear as indigenous, they stop having a collective claim on the land, the resources that are being fought over, and so their disappearance in sort of racial terms facilitates the process of accumulation that I talked about before. Against that, you get the one-drop rule with populations racialized as black. The idea that they can never disappear because they have to be mobilized as workers, as enslaved workers, in perpetuity, effectively, right? And so that blood is understood as strong, as impossible to disappear, etc. Again, different situations of different balance of forces, you get quite different kind of calculations. For example, in the Caribbean and in South America, you get the kind of creation of intermediate stratas, right? So the idea, for example, of mestizos in Latin America is this idea of populations that are not quite indigenous anymore, but that aren't white either, and so that are given more rights, not unlike the Jewish populations in North Africa that I talked about, that are sort of lifted out of indigeneity, but without quite being integrated in settler population. And again, that talks to the different balance of forces, I think, between settler society and indigenous society. Oh yeah, 10 minutes. I'm actually doing better than I thought, which is super dangerous because now I'll start feeling. But that, of course, also happens within the settler population. I've already given you the example of Jewish populations, that populations can be sort of lifted out, can be deracialized in a sense into whiteness. The most famous example of that would be the Irish in North America. The idea that populations that were colonized in Ireland, and in fact were racialized in terms that are extremely similar to the racialization of indigenous populations in the Americas, can be integrated into white society as they arrive in the United States. And there's a wonderful book on how the Irish became white that kind of identifies the question of slavery as being central to this. So that the kind of the political alliance of Irish migration as it arrives in the United States of accepting and defending the institution of slavery becomes the entry point into the sort of the white settler family, right? So to be accepted into a particular to be conscripted into the defense of a particular set of social relations and of domination that made their integration into whiteness possible in the Americas, while of course in Ireland itself they remain very much excluded from the white world and remained. You know, the island is still not entirely free, so it very much remains an ongoing question. Again, I want to avoid the idea that impositions from above are unchallengeable or create new political realities that can never be resisted. And again, the question of the mutability or the social construction, as the shortcut has it in social sciences, of race, can also be mobilized and transformed in process of struggle. And so you have, I think, important moments in revolutionary transformations where people start thinking extremely differently about what we tend to think of as kind of static impositions of racial difference. The Haitian Revolution would be an important example of that, in which the freed, formerly enslaved populations establish an independent republic, and in which they announce in their constitution that to be Haitian is to be black, but that blackness is not one that reproduces the identities that were imposed on the colonizers. And the constitution particularly identified German and Polish soldiers who had fought on the side of the revolution as being integrated into this idea of being Haitians and therefore to be black, right? So the construction of different identities that reject the identities imposed by the colonizers in the process of struggle. I think the example of Steve Biko and the kind of expansive idea of blackness that he proposes in South Africa, that again breaks down the differences that settlers had imposed on so-called black, colored, and Asian populations under a collective kind of understanding of black as being the people that are being exploited, dispossessed, and oppressed by the colonial state, and therefore are the kind of revolutionary agent that can overthrow it, point again to the fact that imposition is one thing that has, of course, real material consequences and realities, but also one that in the process of struggle, indigenous populations have been able to mobilize, reject, and transform. Okay, it'll be a little longer, but I'll do my best. So that, I think, is the second part of what I was trying to do. So the first is, what is settler colonialism? The second is, what are the kind of social realities that settler colonialism created, many of them that are still very much with us and structure our world, in order to be able to naturalize and reproduce its control over land, resources, and people? The last thing I'd want to say is that I think that there is a danger, and one that gets, I think, often reproduced in a lot of writing on settler colonialism, which is to think of settler colonialism as a sort of a self-contained social reality that is sort of made sense of by itself. And I won't have the time, but I encourage you to ask me a question about it. I think that's, for example, true in Palestine now, is that people say, well, the genocide makes sense because of settler colonialism. Now, that's partly true. The genocide is the outcome of a century of settler colonialism and reproduces all forms of power and elimination that has been central to the Zionist project from the beginning. But that in itself, I think, does little to explain why now, why does the entirety of the Western world participate, and actually helps us to get out of what I think is a sort of a language of irrationality, right? That this is, you know, the crazies are in charge in Israel, the West is acting irrationally, etc., and that actually it seems to me that we have to reinscribe settler colonialism as a particular form of domination and accumulation within the wider picture of capitalist social relations to make sense of how the two work together. And there's this famous quote by Marx that many of you will know in volume one of Capital, in the chapter on so-called primitive accumulation, in which he talks about the emergence of capitalism in those words. He says, the discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation, enslavement, and entombment in mines of the aboriginal population, the beginning of the conquest and looting of the East Indies, the turning of Africa into a warren for the commercial hunting of black skins, signaled the rosy dawn of the era of capitalist production. These idyllic proceedings are the chief momenta of primitive accumulation. On their heels treads the commercial war of the European nations with the globe for a theater. And I think what's useful about this is, of course, what Marx is doing at the time, which is to sort of ridicule the political economist of his time, who understood the emergence of capitalism as located in fun-averse Protestants who would keep their money rather than throw banquets and have parties, and that money allowed them to invest in industry and to develop capitalism. Marx says this is nonsense. What makes this possible is this massive process of accumulation on a global scale that comes through murder, exploitation, enslavement, entombment in the mines, etc., etc., etc. But what that points to, I think, is something that remains central today, very briefly, which is that I think settler colonialism, because it is a strategy of domination and of accumulation, is absolutely central both in the emergence and in the reproduction of capitalism. And I want to very briefly sort of give three avenues that I think are useful for us to think, not only historically but today, in how that remains a reality, and therefore that the struggle against settler colonialism and the struggle against capitalism, I think, if done correctly, if I can say it like that, have to be one, because the enemy they confront is one and the same. I think the first, and I've, I think, belabored this quite a bit already, is that settler colonialism is first and foremost a project of accumulation. It is a project of accumulation of wealth on a global scale that made the extraction of natural resources, made free land available, and made populations around the world either available for super exploitation or for mass murder, and actually often both, possible on a global stage. I'm often repeated of this quote by, is it Barbara and Karen Fields? I'm not sure of their first names. Yeah, Barbara and Karen Fields, who write about how many people write about slavery, and they say it, you would think that slavery was primarily about segregation and about racism. And they say this is an odd logic. If you wanted to segregate yourself from a population, why go and get it on the other side of the world and bring it home to put it to work in your society? And so they have this phrase where they say the chief business of slavery was not race relations or segregation, not even racism. It was cotton, sugar, rice, and tobacco. And I think similarly, that's how we should think about settler colonialism, is that primarily it's not about the elimination of the native. It's primarily about making land, gold, silver, also cotton, rice, etc., are available for accumulation on a global stage, and that the particular social relations that I've talked about emerge out of the necessity to make those strategies of accumulation possible and necessary. I have things to say about how I think that links to the emergence of capitalism, and lots of people will fight me over it, but I don't have time, so I'm going to dodge the argument, and you can bring it up in the discussion. I think the second question of why settler colonies are important is the establishment of control over key nodes of the world economy. Is that where settler colonies are placed is often, if not always, about controlling key avenues in the circulation of capital on a global scale. And I think that's important because there's a lot of emphasis, and I think it's not sort of incorrect, I just think it's insufficient, on the kind of the quiet or the mute compulsion of capital. And that mute compulsion is only possible because there's an extremely direct, violent, and bloody compulsion that is continuously being enacted and reproduced, including on the establishment of a global market and global networks of accumulation. And so why did the Dutch establish themselves in the Cape, which then became the basis for the colonization of what would become South Africa? Why did the French take control of the ports in the south of the Mediterranean? Why did different colonial empires fight over the Falklands or the Malvinas, depending on which settler colony you prefer in your historical analysis, etc., etc., etc.? Why did the British fight for the Zionist movement in Palestine? All of those are about establishing control over key nodal points in the circulation of capital on a world on a world scale, and establishing military bases by establishing permanent populations that could defend those networks of accumulation against indigenous rebellion. I think it's very difficult, for example, to make sense of the current genocide without making sense of that central role that settler colonialism has played and continues to play in maintaining and defending that accumulation on a world scale. And then very lastly, Settler colonialism, I think, played, and there's a question mark about the past form, a central role in stabilizing capitalism within the colonial metropoles by getting rid of its internal non-desirables. And that's religious, political, often that's one and the same, economic populations that could lead to rebellion or to resistance at home, and that by expelling them into the colonial world, colonial metropoles were able not only to weaken social contradictions at home, but in the process, increase and accelerate accumulation abroad. And, you know, I teach in Leiden. It's the city from which the pilgrims left before they started the colonization of the Americas. The town is very proud of it. Your presidents regularly come and pray in the church to remember that wonderful history. And of course, who were those populations? They were a religious rebellion minority in England that is kicked out of England and looks for a place in the Netherlands, which it receives for a while until Britain and the Netherlands enter into an alliance against Spain, at which point the repression against the Puritans becomes stronger, and a large amount of them decide that actually they should leave and establish themselves in what would become the United States. That process of turning the internal rebellion rebellious populations at home into the vanguard of accumulation in the colonial world is one that is replayed over and over and over again in the history of settler colonialism, whether it's the sending of the surviving revolutionaries of the Paris Commune to Algeria, or of course of the Jewish populations in Europe to Palestine, where they could establish control over a critical crossroad between the continents, central to the world economy, certainly after the opening of the Suez Canal and the discovery of oil in the region, all of which remains relevant today, out of Europe, where European anti-Semitism didn't want them, into the colonial world, where they could become the vanguard of European power and accumulation. And so that those three things, accumulation, control over key nodal points of the economy, and doing away with social contradictions at the heart of empire, I think were key in the development of capitalist power and in its reproduction today. And I will stop, because otherwise Rosie's going to attack.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.